The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
Good morning. Welcome to the Korea Society and welcome to Studio Korea. We begin the third segment in our morning discussion on the relations among Korea, China, and the United States. And we'll be turning to the issue of Sino-U.S. cooperation, or perhaps lack thereof, in terms of its positions. There has been some discussion already on the denuclearization issue. We'll return to that. And remember that it was only 6 months ago that we did have a series of presidential summits where that issue was brought to the table, the meetings between President Obama and President Park Geun-hye, between President Park Geun-hye and President Xi Jinping, and between President Obama and President Xi Jinping. We'd also like to turn, by way of conclusion, toward longer-term questions of Chinese and American perspectives on the Korean Peninsula and where there may be opportunities or where there are differences in terms of both tactical and strategic approaches. During the intermission, we did receive a question, too, about movement towards more multilateral arrangements, in particular by way of things like joint marine life or maritime parks, and some common sharing, an interesting suggestion in light of some of the earlier discussion this morning. So let us resume with our discussion on the relations among the three, this part of the Robert Scalapino Memorial Dialogue, which we're kicking off here today. If we could turn to the question then of China, the United States, and their perspectives on Korea, I'm wondering if anyone would like to start us off with some basic ideas. I'm seeing Dean Chin.
I would be happy to kick out. The reality that the DPRK is developing nuclear weapon has been a brutal one that we have to see it and to live with it and working hard to defeat it. So far, we have failed. After a decade of hard work, Chinese President Hu Jintao might perceive that we are able to defeat it. We can make a consortium, not a China defeating DPRK, but five countries working together to create a constructive framework in which DPRK would be willing to abandon its nuclear weapon development to trade for security and development. So we have to give appearing security assurances to DPRK and to give development aid so it would get a carrot. Failing this, we are going to punish it with economic disincentive and security kind of pressure for DPRK to choose between incentive and disincentive. So this is was China's first emboldened leadership in a multilateral way to deal with a threat. For ages, we were accustomed to a bilateral setting. We feel comfortable with bilateral setting because we are a big country and we are confident. We are only less confident vis-a-vis the US. For smaller country, we are more confident. So China was averse with multilateralism. But through engaging with the ARF, APEC, this kind of a security or economic regional setting for a decade or two, China become more expert on participating in such international system, concluding it does no harm for China to engage through multilateralism. And naturally, China can use multilateralism to make the U.S. Less hegemonic, because Americans would be bound with the same rule, same system as we would. So all countries would be bound by the same thing. So rather than China-U.S. bilateral, we make more concession. So it's unequal. But with DPRK, we really feel frustrated. I think at a time when last year, when early this year, President Hu Jintao stepped down, he might recognize he overestimated China's capacity to coerce DPRK to abandon nuclear weapon. And he may conclude that we do not have the leverage to succeed in doing it. And someone this morning has already mentioned that given Johnson Tech's case, China apparently does not have sufficient leverage. DPRK did not consult with China. For someone who is a leading China hand, DPRK's point person, it's a window with China. China would feel hurt that such a China expert were killed without consulting with China. So China truly has equal, normal relationship with DPRK, without very friendly, very cordial relationship that DPRK would think, this guy has some China link, so I need to report to China before killing him. And they used to tell China that they are going to test nuclear weapon at least 30 minutes before exploding it. This time, no minute in advance time. But China would still say it's their internal affairs. It's their man, not a Chinese man. Therefore, China would reflect why we withdrew our troops in 1958 from North Korea. If Chinese army is still stationed in North Korea, they would be deeply concerned that China can support some pro-China North Korean leader to have something to protect this pro-China North Korean leadership. So they won't do this kind of non-respective things. So China would reflect. So the station armed force abroad may bring a bad image of our hegemony, but could protect China's interest in that country. So DPRK's action would make China more mature over time. But this time, we lost a person that, who knows China, who knows how to best to deal with China, protecting North Korean interest without hurting China. And North Korea need to figure out who will be the next one to do this job. I believe they would find many successes. But given the current situation, how China should be realistic so that we don't have the capacity to shape its nuclear policy. They are soaring. With Soviet Union Airlines gone, with China Airlines nominally in paper, but the Chinese Foreign Ministry from October 2006, and the Defense Ministry's spokesperson spring this year, repeatedly try to de-link China and with North Korea through the defense military allies, saying the foreign ministry spokesperson saying that I'm not informed of the China North Korean military allies. Liu Jianchao said when asked what about the brother bond allies, he said, "What allies? Brother bond? Never heard of."
Well, let me ask you a few.
And this defense ministry spokesperson said, don't ask me question. what if there is a war, China would support DPRK or not? He said, I'll never ask question which is assumptional. Meaning only when the war would break, we would do something. Prior to that, we would not tell you. I don't think the U.S. would tell Japan. U.S. would not assure you to protect you or not. U.S. would say Article 5 of the Defense Treaty is applicable to Senkaku to assure Japan. China says the treaty is there, but I would not tell everybody if it is applicable. Only if a war would happen, you automatically would know what would happen. So DPRK is not sure if China is genuine anymore to protect it. Most likely China would, but China does not want to let DPRK to know that they are guaranteed to have this, especially when they would launch an offensive first. Therefore, China is very reluctant to provide, as they did on the case of Chonan, not Chonan, that I'm not sure, for Yampion Island. So DPRK think Russia, China are not reliable, U.S. still hostile, and South Korea increasingly competent. From a realistic approach, their only option of national security is self-defense, not allies, not collective defense through the United Nations Security Council. Therefore, I think they have made a seasoned decision. But for China's own national interest, we don't think their seasoned choice is good for us. And no matter it is for regional stability or for China's self-interest, our interest is would be more important than their interest, rather than what happened 63 years ago. Their peninsula-wide national unification is more important than our national unification. So now China does not want to let them to detract our strategy, which is stability, development, harmonious unification among all Chinese. And they can disrupt us. So we have to be tough with them. And America could work with us. This would provide us an opportunity for China and America would have more strategic issues to work together rather than to divert against each other. But we failed to succeed in this. We intend to do, but we did not succeed. So the new president, I think this year has been excited by DPRK. He knows we should not overestimate, but he knows that between the threat of America, which would be backing Asia, pivoting, rebalance, and the threat from DPRK to continue to test its missile, satellite, and nuclear device, probably DPRK's threat is more imminent. America's threat is kind of balancing. To assure China would not be aggressive. And indeed, we don't want to be aggressive, but some of our behavior has not been better understood. So we have to revise our behavior to make it better acceptable. But China-U.S. share common interest that we cannot accept the DPRK, so seasoned choice. So we have to defeat it. But pessimistically, I think it's too late. It's not realistic to revert. So how to contain, to make it not to use its nuclear capacity to threat? In case it would threat, we have to defeat it politically and militarily through the UN framework and through the US ROK alliance and through China ROK strategic partnership, we have to defeat. So China has much more to think about. China ROK strategic partnership is not a strategic alliance, is a stabilizing tool for this area which benefits DPRK. And how make ROK better trust China? China has a tool. We can expand the tool and possibly in the future, before DPRK's nuclear weapon is denuclearized, we may tap the current framework of six-party talk to six-party regional or sub-regional security and confidence building regional system. So we all live under nuclear umbrella, nuclear cloud, China, US, Russia, ROK under the US, Japan under the US, and DPRK under itself. We don't accept with each other. China cannot accept the US. US cannot accept Russia and the Chinese. And the rest of five cannot accept DPRK. But before removing DPRK's nuclear weapon technology capability, how to make DPRK to promise it's not going to use its capability to threat as it uttered in April this year. That offended my president. China just announced its nuclear protection to Ukraine. This is China's innovative way to make Ukraine committed to non-proliferation. This is something China did not do before. China always used negative security assurance, meaning no use, no first use. This time, use for, no use against someone. This time, use for someone, for Ukraine, as long as you don't have a nuclear weapon. So China may also need to refresh its mind. We may think nuclear military alliance is Cold War mentality. But this time, we use Cold War mentality for China security, for Ukraine security. Could we use Cold War mentality to make DPRK to regain China's protection, to trade for its abandoning of nuclear weapon? China would say, if you would abandon, we reassure you that we would protect you, as long as you are on the defensive side, not on offensive side, which means to do something on Chongnai, to do something on Yinping Island. So I think China need to use a creative way, which may be a Cold War way, like American way, to assure Japan on Senkaku that China does not like, but that makes Japan less militant. So we need to use all kinds of means to make a DPRK abandon its nuclear weapon capability and eventually to abandon the entire program. But it takes years, if not decades.
Ralph Kossa and then John DeLore.
Yeah, I a couple of points. First of all, I think to understand the prospects for a U.S.-China cooperation on North Korea, you have to look at the bigger relationship first, what the status is there. And there we shouldn't underestimate the importance of the Sunnylands Summit. I think it really did set a very positive tone. And I think there was a very simple message that this new type of major country relations says. And that's essentially both presidents trying to persuade the hardliners in their own countries that a conflict between a rising power and an established power is not inevitable. And that sort of set the tone for cooperation, and I personally have seen a much more positive approach toward U.S.-China relations among people in China as a result of that Sunnyland summit. I think it was a measure of Obama's respect for Xi as he was just coming in. I think it did set a very positive tone, and I think that does open the door for greater cooperation. Add to that the fact that the North Koreans are, in fact, acting in a way that is undermining China's strategic interests. Clearly, the Chinese are upset about that. To me, the real problem, however, is that when you talk with the North Koreans, they're incredibly arrogant and incredibly self-confident and seem to believe that China needs them more than they need China, and that China will not let North Korea collapse. And until China persuades North Korea otherwise, I think the leverage that China has is incapable of being used. I have argued to Chinese colleagues that rather than build walls along the border, Chinese should start building some refugee camps. The day the North Koreans see that, they'll say, oh my God, they are ready for us to collapse. It would change, I think, their attitude completely. The same thing when defectors come across the border, high profile, give some of them free passage. to the South. I think these would send the kind of messages to North Korea that they need to hear, that China is prepared to let North Korea collapse if North Korea is not prepared to act in a manner that doesn't undermine Chinese national security interests. But right now, the Chinese or the North Koreans still seem to believe that they have the leverage. And as long as they believe that, it's going to be very hard to get them to cooperate on denuclearization or on anything else. I think that's part of the real challenge.
Yeah. Very interesting, Ralph. We do have reports this morning that China is massing troops again in the Northeast, probably just a standard precautionary given what we discussed in terms of the political activity in Pyongyang.
I mean, the point, Steve, if I could interject, we keep hearing about, well, the Chinese are worried about a flow of refugees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are more people born in China every year than live in North Korea. If you took the entire population of North Korea and put them two in a village in China, you wouldn't even know they existed. So, I think China needs to sort of get over this. And they're not going to come to China to stay. They're going to come to China until it's safe to go back home. So I think some of these fears are, quite frankly, overblown.
Very interesting points. Thank you. John.
Yeah, I agree with Ralph for different reasons and moving in a different direction that Professor Shen's idea is sort of a dead end in terms of China providing that security guarantee to North Korea. I mean, it's kind of the same point, but you know, that you do experience in visiting North Korea, talking to the North Koreans, and in looking at their policy. I mean, they fundamentally distrust China. They're not looking. They don't want to get themselves in a position where China is providing any more than it's already providing. You know, already their foreign policy is unbalanced in the way that they've conducted it for 60 years because all their eggs are in the Chinese basket to some extent, and they're not comfortable with that position. So, you know, ultimately, if there's any kind of, if some of us probably at this table don't think that North Korea seriously wants a security guarantee, but if you do think that they are insecure and that their nuclear program is a symptom of that, and if you want to get them to denuclearize or start down the road of denuclearization, you have to address their security concerns. Yeah, I think the key is the United States, not China, and that's where North Korea is looking for a guarantee. You know, and I mean, Shen Dingli already mentioned in 1958, by removing troops, China put itself in a fundamentally different position. Even more so in 92, by normalizing relations with South Korea, and now we see it very openly pursuing a strategic close relationship with South Korea. I mean, think about that from a North Korean perspective. It's completely asymmetrical with the United States, which has remained firm in its position of no cross recognition, you know. So I don't really see that as a path that's going to work. I think probably Ralph and I and others disagree at some level. I mean, I continue to think talking with the North Koreans, I'm as pessimistic as probably everyone about any kind of short-term denuclearization, but at least I think we can negotiate for freezes and inspections where we have more sense of what's going on and we can slow down what they're doing because just lost the camera. Should we stop or continue?
Peter?
It's okay.
Okay, we'll pick it up on that camera.
Okay.
Keep going.
So that was a divine intervention. I guess I said the wrong thing there.
This part will be edited out. Go ahead.
That's the NSA. They can automatically.
They've taken you down, Josh.
Well, I lost visuals. Well, it worked. I've lost my train of thought. But
we can at least get a freeze.
We can at least negotiate for a freeze.
We need the stability.
And the role for China and for that matter for South Korea, and we should talk about inter-Korean relations and all this, mm-hmm. You know, the role for China is not to just publicly call for a resumption of six-party talks, but to really get in there. And I think they are making this effort. We don't know, or certainly I don't know, back channel what's really going on. But at least we're seeing the kind of shuttle diplomacy where senior Chinese officials are going back to Pyongyang now regularly and then going to Washington and receiving North Koreans. And, you know, that's the work. It's a hard slog, but that's what the Chinese can do to figure out, is there a credible deal, interim deal, that the North Koreans will make, that the Chinese can then convince Obama to say, you know, that's the kind of guarantee. Mm-hmm. It's not this fundamental security guarantee. It's sort of a diplomatic guarantee that, mm-hmm. no, we really think they'll go through with this. Just the last point is, you know, Professor Shen was right to frame all this in terms of Jangsong Tech, because a critical question now, of course, is talk about domestic determinants of policy. You know, we have to let the dust settle or slash urgently figure out who's really in control there. I mean, right now, as Ralph said, we're seeing everyone come up with their theory. This was the hardliners. This is Kim Jong-un. This is a messy divorce with Kim Kyung-hee. I mean, this is Kim Jong-nam working with the Chinese. Everything is possible at this point. And that's a critical question. We haven't thought about it in terms of the nuclear issue, but one thing that's striking is Jiang is not closely associated with that, to my knowledge, you know. And the questions we're asking is, what's the fallout with China? What's the fallout with economic reform and other sorts of questions? But, you know, it would, at first glance, sort of a priori, it doesn't seem to affect the current strategy. The Byungjin line they articulated and what they seem to be doing is moving forward with their nuclear program quantitatively and qualitatively. Mm-hmm. And if China and the United States can figure out, and South Korea, can figure out a way to negotiate them to deflect that, then all these risks that we worry about the North Koreans having more and better stuff, just continue to get more severe.
Mm-hmm. Han Suk-hee?
I'd like to talk about a little later.
Mm-hmm. So. Very good. Okay. Scott?
I want to start where Ralph started, and that is with the new type of major country relationship, because I do think that really creates a needed framework for the potential for cooperation between the U.S. and China. And of course, against the backdrop of the third North Korean nuclear test in February, we have seen China elevate denuclearization as a priority within the bounds of maintaining stability in North Korea. But I also think that even despite this new framework, both countries are finding it very difficult to find practical gains on security cooperation in the region. The good news, in an odd sort of way, is that compared to the South China Sea and the East China Sea, North Korea may be the easiest mountain to climb for the U.S. And China. But I think it is still the case that the U.S. and China, in terms of preferred end states and preferred means of dealing with the North Korea question, are coming from very different perspectives. China is edging toward accepting the idea that sanctions can be useful to a point, but I don't see it likely that China is going to be willing to take the steps that the U.S. might desire in order to force North Korea to make a strategic choice, because those steps might possibly involve destabilization. And so as a result, I think that China's cooperation is going to stop short. And we also have this odd situation where everybody in China thinks that, well, all we need to solve the North Korea problem is that it's really in the hands of the U.S., and everybody in the U.S. says, well, it's in the hands of China. The other area that I think is interesting and complicated is, in fact, if we look at the idea of a Northeast Asian regime for multilateral security cooperation, I think everybody agrees at this point that that is something that would be desirable. China wants to institutionalize six-party talks. South Korea is talking about a Northeast Asia Peace and Cooperation Initiative. You know, maybe the challenge there is trying to figure out whether it's necessary to go through North Korea by solving the North Korea problem in order to get to that regime, or whether there is another way, an incremental way, to try to build out some form of multilateral cooperation as a means by which to do that. And I actually think that the, you know, ADIZ set of issues, you know, further raises, at least rhetorically, the recognition within the region among all parties that there really does need to be that mechanism. The problem is that because of the strategic distrust that still underlies really the U.S.-China relationship, it's very hard to imagine how we're going to get there in practice.
When you invoke the words North Korea's denuclearization, there are at least two questions that one should give serious consideration to. Is such a thing possible, denuclearization of a nuclear weapon state? Are there any precedents? Well, we know that no nuclear weapons possessing state has ever bargained away its nuclear arsenal for political or economic rewards without a change in the leadership. Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Belarus, South Africa, all the new leadership in those countries all found the political will and opportunity to reorient their policy toward the U.S. and the West. In the case of North Korea, we've had the same family regime for over 60 years, we know. If you think of the world's de facto nuclear weapons possessing states, the nine nuclear weapon states, which nation would be most likely to bargain away its nuclear weapons? One does not think that China is a likely candidate, or the United States, or Russia. India, Pakistan, I think many of you would disagree. What about North Korea? Well, by the sole virtue of North Korea being an impoverished country, many people assume that North Korea may be more amenable to bargaining away its nuclear weapons program in return for massive aid. But then that begs the following question. A corollary to that assumption is, what happens after all the blandishments, the money, and the food, and so forth, run dry? What do you do 5 years from now, 10 years from now, if you are this tiny, impoverished North Korean state? Continue to go on depending on the goodwill of your neighbors? That would be extremely poor national policy. My point here is, among the nine nuclear states, North Korea is not the most likely nation to give away its nuclear weapons. On the subject of the role of China in all this, in the aftermath of North Korea's bluster barrage earlier this year, the view in Washington was, hey, maybe the new leadership in Beijing will, again, do the right thing. Why? Because they're telling us so. They're telling us how displeased the Xi Jinping leadership is with North Korea. They're telling us they're going to take some actions, that this is unacceptable. But unacceptable is what China and the U.S. have uttered in the aftermath of all three nuclear tests and other weapons tests. Unacceptable. From the North Korean vantage point, that doesn't really sound like a threat. There are many, I will not count the ways that China loves North Korea, but let me count the ways that North Korea has defied China repeatedly over the past 60 years, give you some examples. Kim Il-sung is basically Chinese. His family moved to China when he was about 10 years old, learned to speak Chinese. Despite that cultural affinity for China, one of the first things he did upon seizing power formally, or upon the establishment of the DPRK in 1948, was to root out all use of Chinese characters in official documents in the public sphere, to use only the Korean phonetical system. Now, you may say that is petty, not really an insult toward China, it's a manifestation of Korean nationalism. Fine. During the Korean War, we know China literally saved the DPRK from collapsing, gave gratis, China gave North Korea gratis, $325 million or so in aid. And during the Cold War, of course, China, along with the Soviet Union, was the most important benefactor to Pyongyang. And in the post-Cold War era, I hardly need to say that, what the role of China has been over the past 20 years. During this time, North Korea defied China in the following ways. In 1956, Russia, the Soviet Union, and China sent a joint mission, high-profile people, to Pyongyang to admonish Kim Il-sung, to try to prevent him from killing off, purging pro-Soviet and pro-Chinese rivals. Kim Il-sung said, okay, well, the Chinese delegate was none other than Peng Dehuai, the Chinese commander in the Korean War. Kim Il-sung said, okay, okay. And then over the course of the next few years, he you know, methodically rooted out, killed, imprisoned all pro-Chinese and pro-Soviet North Koreans. And for good measure, he leveled Chinese cemeteries, the tombs of fallen Chinese soldiers in the Korean War, to downplay China's critical role in that war. Later on, Kim Il-sung in 1983, when the succession issue came to the fore, brought his son to Beijing to win China's approval for the hereditary power transition down to Kim Jong-il. Once the Chinese reluctantly agreed to it, despite not being comfortable with it, and Kim Il-sung told Deng Xiaoping, you know, if you give us your support, I will send Kim Jong-il to China once a year, every year, to study China's economic reform and so forth. I will send him to your hometown, Sichuan province, and so forth. We know nothing of the sort happened. But once the Kims got the Chinese approval, they used China as a foil to send mixed signals to Washington. In the fall of 1983, China found itself in a position of conveying North Korean message to Washington, the message being North Korea wants to talk to Americans, to Washington. And Deng Xiaoping was pleased with that, thinking North Korea is finally changing. It so happened the day that Beijing transmitted such a message in October, the next day, which was October 9th, the bomb in Rangoon at the Martyrs Mausoleum went off. And thereafter, Deng Xiaoping vowed never to allow Kim Jong-il to visit China. Yet, the subsidies kept pouring in. In more recent times, in August 2010, when Kim Jong-il visited China on the issue of handing down power to his son, Kim Jong-il purportedly told Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, this is, quote, a false rumor from the West. Less than a month later, he appointed his son four-star general. My point is, North Korea has toyed around with the Chinese for over 60 years, and Chinese, gritting their teeth out of strategic interests, continued to support North Korea. And that correlation of international forces in the region between the DPRK and the PRC will go on for the foreseeable future. Only if we come to a near disaster situation, which directly impinges on Chinese national interest, a nuclear reactor fallout, for example, with health implications to the Chinese, a shooting war within North Korea between rival factions, you might have a common enemy then among China, US, and South Korea. But that kind of alternative future is impossible to engineer, hard to predict, and we don't see anything like that yet. So I think Washington should dispossess itself of the view that the Xi Jinping leadership, by virtue of being irritated with Kim Jong-un and just by the virtue of being new, will move in a different direction from its predecessor.
I'd like to raise some other issue that maybe as we just look at it, the East Asian phenomenon, East Asian problem cannot be resolved with the power. So that's why our government currently try to raise the issue of trust. From realistic perspective, it's a kind of naive term. But I think if we take a look at the current situation of Asia paradox, which is economically we are so all woven and we are very actively, we just interact with each other. But at the same time, if we're talking about security and political issue, we tend to very confrontational and very competitive. So in order to fix or in order to resolve this kind of problem, the power would have some limitation to resolve this one. And instead, we try to raise the issue of trust. But President Park raised trust with North Korea. North Korea responded with the nuclear test. So it has kind of paralyzed the bilateral relationship between North Korea and South Korea. So we try to raise the issue of international trust building within that structure. We try to put North Korea into it. That might be a good kind of way to denuclearize and to make North Korea to be part of our community. So that will be the Northeast Asia Peace and Cooperation Initiative, which is in the process of we're still developing that one. This is on process, and then I and And Scott, we just have involved in that kind of process that we try to discuss about the validity of this kind of Northeast Asian Peace and Cooperation Initiative. I think this initiative is quite different from what Professor Yisung Yu said, that the honest broker, the current government would not make any initiative or any attempt to make an honest broker among the big countries. We try to raise the issue then, how can we deal with this kind of common problem? We try to raise an issue that we have to get together and we have to share our own problem together. That will be our initiative. So Asia, kind of NAPSI, Northeast Asia, Northeast Asia Peace and Cooperation Initiative, is we called it as a solve process, because if China raise an issue or China initiate or Japan initiate, that would not make any successful outcome. Instead, if Korea or Seoul, we try to make initiative, then the rest of country, they would follow us. That would be the major the reason that we try to raise the issue. But that does mean that we will take a leadership for a long time. Once we just engine up, or once we just initiate this kind of process, and then we try to levy all the participants as a responsibility for making this this kind of initiative successful. So, and also in order to draw up a cooperation and trust, we try to raise an issue of a soft security initiative, which includes some environmental problem, just a blue sky project or aging society project or kind of a nuclear safety project. Those kind of things would be a common issue that we try to convene, and we try to share our idea in order to have a common security. We try to just discuss about this one. For example, before we start this kind of session, I just talked to Shanding Li and how it's air in Beijing, in Shanghai, and blue sky project. If you take a look at the smoke in Beijing and Shanghai, all of a sudden it blows and it coming to Seoul. And another blow is coming to Tokyo, so it's kind of common phenomena. And so we have to get together and we have to talk about this kind of issue. In the meantime, we will develop our own trust. And based on that trust, we have to put the North Korea into it, and then we can resolve. This is kind of a new approach. It's more like a diplomatic and more like a constructive approach to deal with the North Korean issue.
We actually are at our designated point to close, and I did just want to take a chance here to thank very much our guests who have flown or trained great distances to be with us. I'd like to thank Professor Han Suki of Yonsei University, Professor John DeLore of Yonsei University, Ralph Kosa, the president of Pacific Forum, CSIS, Professor Sungyun Lee of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, Scott Snyder, director and senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Professor and Dean Shending Li of Fudan University. Thank you all for taking the time to be here. I could ask for a round of applause.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.